Well, last week we looked at Numbers 29 and 30, which was about the feasts and sacrifices that God wanted the people to make when they got into the promised land. He said to do it with care. In other words, be sure to complete the offerings. And he gave some specific instructions about them. He listed them for Moses to pass on, and there were 10 of them. There was the continual burnt offering that happened every day. There was a Sabbath burnt offering. There was a monthly or new moon offering. The Passover meal. The Feast of Unleavened Bread that followed the Passover. And then there were numerous ones about their harvesting times. The first was the first fruit offering. And the next was the Feast of Weeks that would come weeks after that for the second spring harvest. And then there was the Feast of Trumpets and the Day of Atonement, followed by the Feast of Booths, or the ingathering for the fall offering. You'll have to bear with me a little bit today. My allergies decided yesterday that that was the day. So I'm working my way through that with some help from modern medicine. Not much help, it doesn't feel like. But anyway, so God established all these feasts. They're all to worship Him. A big part of many of them were burnt offerings, many animals sacrificed, and a lot of them also then said, and an atonement, a goat for atonement, and atonement lambs. It was just a big part of just the worship and recognizing their sin, recognizing what God had done. There was worship of Yahweh involved, remembering of events and His actions on their behalf. One of those was the establishment of the priesthood. When He established the priesthood, that's when He established the daily burnt offerings, two lambs a day. And there was also the Passover, a major event leaving Israel. There was the Feast of Unleavened Bread about their haste in leaving, and also about the purity, the sinlessness, the running from sin and elimination of sin that was a part of it. And of course, many were about the harvest and the ingathering of what God provided through their agriculture. By nature, the burnt offerings were not only worship and to celebrate Yahweh, but also it conveyed a personal dedication of the people to be continually faithful to Yahweh as He led them. We also spent some time in Hebrews chapter 10, looking at the first four verses and 11 through 14 as well. And in the book of Hebrews, it compares these offerings of animals with the offering of Jesus Christ as He gave His life on the cross, showing the extreme differential between them and how far superior the offering that Christ made of Himself was, that it really truly was an offering that dealt with the sin of men, could bring a clear conscience, where the sacrifices had to be done over and over and over again. And it's just very clear when we think about looking back at those chapters in Numbers, it would have been a very different culture with the amount of sacrifice, death of animals, the bloodiness of it, that they lived in, that was a constant teacher, turning them toward recognizing their own sin and so on. But Jesus made an offering once for all. Sin was truly atoned for all time. And the blood of bulls and goats were a good type to show us something about Christ and His sacrifice to come and the fullness of that in later years. So today we're going to begin chapter 30 of Numbers. And I'm going to read the whole chapter, and then we'll talk about this a little bit. There are some things that really need to be said, but listen to these words. Then Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes of the sons of Israel, saying, "This is the word which the Lord has commanded. If a man makes a vow to the Lord or takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. Also, if a woman makes a vow to the Lord and binds herself by an obligation in her husband's house, in her youth, and her father hears the vow and her obligation by which she has bound herself, and her father says nothing to her, then all her vows shall stand, and every obligation by which she was bound herself shall stand. But if the father should forbid her on the day when he hears of it, none of her vows or her obligations by which she has bound herself shall stand, and the Lord will forgive her because her father has forbidden her. However, if she would marry while under her vows, or the rash statement of her lips by which she has bound herself, and her husband hears of it, and says nothing to her on the day he hears of it, then her vow shall stand, and her obligations by which she has bound herself shall stand. But if on the day her husband hears of it, he forbids her, then he shall annul her vow which she is under, and the rash statement of her lips by which she has bound herself, and the Lord will forgive her. But the vow of a widow or of a divorced woman, everything by which she has bound herself, shall stand against her. However, if she vowed in her husband's house, or bound herself by an obligation with an oath, and her husband heard it, but said nothing to her and did not forbid her, then all her vows shall stand, and every obligation by which she has bound herself shall stand. But if her husband indeed annuls them on the day when he hears of them, then whatever proceeds out of her lips concerning her vows or her concerning the obligation of herself shall not stand. Her husband has annulled them, and the Lord will forgive her. Every vow and every binding oath to humble herself, her husband may confirm it, or her husband may annul it. But if her husband indeed says nothing to her from day to day, then he confirms all her vows and all her obligations which are on her. He has confirmed them because he said nothing to her on the day he heard them. But if indeed he annuls them after he has heard them, then he shall bear her guilt. These are the statutes which the Lord commanded Moses, as between a man and his wife, and between a father and his daughter, while she is in her youth in her father's house. Probably not a passage that you're going to hear a lot in today's culture. And so we need to take a look at this and see what is here so that we might understand it well. It starts off in verse 1 that Moses goes to the head of the tribes and says, Yahweh's commanded, and then he gives these commands. And it starts out in verse 2, if a man makes a vow to Yahweh or takes an oath, he's got a binding obligation. He shall not violate his word. He shall do whatever he said. It's a call to honesty, integrity. Keep your commitments. Commitments are described here a couple of ways. One is a vow to Yahweh, and the other is to take an oath of an obligation. So what are we talking about when we talk about a vow to Yahweh or an oath for an obligation? Well, this is, I went back to look through the concordances and so on about vows and these kinds of things. And the first time that this word for vow is used in the Bible is actually in Genesis 28, verses 20 to 22. And we'll read those verses in a few minutes if you want to turn there. But let me set the stage. Jacob had just deceived his father Isaac and had been given the elder son's blessing instead of Esau. Esau was more than a little upset. And Jacob then is sent away to Haran by his parents to find a wife. And on the way he spends a night and he places his head on a stone. And during that time is when we get Jacob's dream. He sees a ladder coming down out of earth to heaven, and angels of God ascending and descending on that ladder. And this is a meeting between Christ and Jacob that is just, I've heard some outstanding sermons preached on this. R.C. Sproul's got one that's just phenomenal. We're not going to stop and take the time for that today. But Yahweh stood above it, and he said, I am the God of Abraham and Isaac. And I've made promises. I promised this land for you and for your descendants. And your descendants will be like the dust of the land. I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. And so Jacob has this dream, and he's given these promises. They're a revoicing of the same promises that were given to Abraham, and that's a part of this dream. And Jacob then, it says, arose early and set up a pillar, which was made out of the rock that he'd placed his head on. And he said, surely Yahweh was in this place, and I did not know it. And it said he was afraid. So let's go over to Genesis 28 and read verses 20 through 22. Genesis 28, verses 20 through 22. Taking us back to our study in the book of Genesis here a bit. I'm on the right page. Genesis 28, 20 through 22. And this is the first time the word vow is used in the scriptures. And this is what it says. 20 through 22. This stone which I have, that's verse 22. 20. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take, and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. This stone which I have set up as a pillar will be God's house, and of all you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. And so here is Jacob with a certain level of fear. He's afraid. He's heard this from God. It was probably just having this kind of an interaction with God probably brought about a certain level of fear. You know, what's going on? Where am I? What's happening? And he put some ifs in the front of this vow, basically saying, if you keep your promises, if you keep me, if you take me on this journey, you give me the food I need, and you bring me back to my father's land, then you will be my God. And he sets this stone up as a reminder and as a point of obligation. You know, no one can deny that this vow didn't happen. Here's the stone. Here's where it happened. And here was what I committed to. And certainly, Jacob, as he continues on his trip, he doesn't wait till he gets back to say, okay, Yahweh, you did it all. Now I see you're really God. I mean, as he lives out his time on the rest of this travel, he sees God as his God. But you can see through the rest of Jacob's life, as we studied that, he kept this vow. And so this is the first vow we see in the scriptures where it uses that term for that kind of a commitment. It's a personal commitment on Jacob's part to follow Yahweh, which we see was done from his life. And as a matter of fact, as he did that, he enthusiastically trusted and followed Yahweh. As he was in the land of Haran, as he was there with his father-in-law, and his father-in-law kept making deals to get the best of him, Jacob trusted God to prosper him, and he did. And God even came to him and said, it's time for you to go. As a matter of fact, that happens in Genesis chapter 31. God's interacting with Jacob as he contemplates what to do about leaving his father-in-law. And God simply tells him, it's time to go. And so he's following God in the course of keeping that vow. The next time it shows up is in Numbers chapter 6. And we studied that. That was the Nazirite vow. It was a dedication by separation. A person could come and set themselves apart for focused dedication and service to God for a determined time. And it was determined by the one making the vow, and they would come and desire to do this. Only the Levites could be priests, but anyone could make this vow and set themselves apart for God's service. And a part of that setting apart was to stay away from certain things and certain activities. Baseline was, you don't have anything to do with products made from grapes. And it isn't just thinking about the beverage kind of thing that might come from it, but it included the stems and the skins and the seeds and everything. And there was also no hair cutting and no shaving and no contact with dead bodies, or you had to start the vow over. But it was something that God established. If you want to set yourself apart for this, then you can do that. As a matter of fact, let's look at Leviticus chapter 27, verses 1 and 2. It describes it there very well. Oops, wrong way. Leviticus 27, 1 and 2. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, yes, no, this is correct. In Leviticus 27, 1 and 2, we get some more details about how these vows might be done. This one, I'm sorry, I am off a little bit on this. Leviticus 27, 1 and 2 is if a person makes a difficult vow, this is the next one. And I'm going to read this with you, just these two verses, and then we'll talk about the general context of what follows. It says, again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man makes a difficult vow, he shall be valued according to your valuation or persons belonging to the Lord. If your valuation is of the male, I'm sorry, then we can keep going, but I'll just read verse 3. If the valuation is of the male from 20 years even to 60 years old, then your valuation shall be 50 shekels of silver after the shekel of the sanctuary. And this is about vows or where a person is coming and saying, I'm going to give something. It could be he's going to give animals for the use of God in managing the priesthood and all those things. He could say, I'm giving myself for service. I'm dedicating a child for service. And there's a lot of those things. It's something that's going to be set aside for the Lord's use. It could be a person, it could be an animal, it could be objects. And Moses says, Moses is told, put a value on it. And this valuation is to be done by the priest. And under many circumstances, if you wanted to redeem what you vowed, you could. You could say, well, that lamb I was going to give, I would prefer to redeem it with money. And so that's why it's valued. But the redemption is the original value plus 20%. So you're going to pay a premium to bring something out of that vow. But this is where you're making a sacrifice, giving of yourself to the Lord. And they made this provision for redemption. And this is another use of the vow. And then in verse 2, back in Numbers 30, we also saw an oath of obligation. It's a promise to do or not to do something. Could be made to people. And so in the vow, we see commitments made to God or in the presence of God. Somebody might say, vow it in the name of God, I'm going to do this. And then they were committed to themselves and to God. It kind of moved it to a relationship to do something that involved God. But the oath would be those interpersonal things where you just simply gave your word to do something. And so in verse 2, if it says a man makes a vow or an oath to do something, he's going to be honest. He's not going to violate his word. He's going to do what he said, and it effectively moves all these promises to a commitment to God with regard to obedience. And then the rest of the chapter is going to be talking about how to handle the vows of women. And this certainly, in our current culture, would not be something that was readily embraced. I'll just put it that way. But there's a number of circumstances here. The first one we see in verses 3 through 5. If a woman's still in her father's home as a youth, makes a vow or an obligation, and the father hears it, if he's silent, he's basically giving his endorsement to it. But if he desires to, if he thinks it's the right thing to do, he can forbid it. But he has to do it at the day he hears about it. If he forbids it, then the vow is void, and Yahweh is going to forgive her because the vow no longer has basis. If the woman marries while under vows or some statement that she's made, the New American Standard said a rash statement. I went to look at the background behind that. I didn't find a lot. It could be a hasty statement. It could be simply an uttered statement, depending on how they wanted to translate the verb. But the word's only used twice in the Bible, so we don't have a lot of other examples. Some of the other versions say uttered word or impulsive word. But she marries while under some sort of a vow, or when her husband hears it. So when he finds out what she has vowed to do, if he says nothing again, the vow stands. But if he forbids her on the day of the hearing, his hearing of it, then that vow is made void and the Lord forgives the vow. Verse 9 is very straightforward. If a widow or divorced woman makes a vow, that vow will stand. Verses 10 through 12 says, but if the vow was made in her husband's house, when the husband hears it, on the day he hears it, once again, silence endorses the vow and it stands. If he voices that this is to be voided, then the vow no longer stands and the Lord has released her from the vow. Verse 13 is kind of a summary statement. Every woman's vow, a husband can confirm or annul it, but in verses 14 and 15, it explains that a bit to indicate that if the husband says nothing, the vow's confirmed on the day he hears of it. And if he then annuls it after hearing about it, then he becomes guilty with regard to the completing of that vow. And in verse 16, it says, this is God's commandment regarding a man and a wife or a father and a daughter. And so I guess I've got a question. As you hear all that about keeping honest, I think we would have an easy time going, we need to be honest. If we say we're going to do something, we need to do it. If we make a vow to God, we need to keep that vow. All of these interactions with the woman that puts her husband or her father, if she's in her youth, in this role, what do you think of all that? What's your reaction to that? What's that?
It shows authority and headship of father and husband.
It does show a bit of authority there. Yes. Is that the way you would expect it to work in today's world? No. Do you suppose that some very fine Christian women would go, it's not how we do it, and we're not starting today? I want to take us through some verses, and I think they're important. I think it's important to stop and give this some careful thought so that we can really understand what's happening here, that it is something that God put in place here, but not just here. And I think the place it starts, Genesis chapter 2, verse 18. Turn over to Genesis 2:18. You know what this chapter is about, the creation of man and woman. And as God is going through the process, he's created the animals, Adam's named him, and so on, God comes to this and makes this statement in verse 18. Then the Lord God said, it is not good for the man to be alone. I will make a helper suitable to him or for him. And it's very clear that in the way that God views the relationship at this point, he's making another to come alongside. We could quickly say, we would gladly say, complete him. It's not good that he's alone. He's not complete as by himself. But a part of that role is to be a helper that's suitable to be with him and do the things that God is assigning to be done. Now, after the sin is also important. Go over to chapter 3, verses 16 and 17. And I'm not telling you anything you haven't been taught before. But after the fall of man, and God has pronounced various kinds of judgments, this is one of the judgments that's in this. section where God is doing that. So 16 and 17, to the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth. In your pain will bring forth children, yet your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Then to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree about which I commanded you, saying you shall not eat from it, cursed is the ground because of you, and toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. And there is this contention that God says is set up now between man and woman. The man is to have dominion over his wife, and his wife, the woman, says your desire will be for your husband, and most people will interpret that to mean for his position rather than for the one that they find themselves in. Now, it would be very easy to say that the words we read in Numbers and even some of what we see in Genesis might be modified by culture. That's not the culture we live in. Things have happened. The relationships are a little different. And so the world has changed and so on. But let's go over to Ephesians chapter 5. And we embrace Ephesians 5 very quickly. And we do so often without the context of thinking back to what we saw in Genesis and in Numbers and in other places. And so when we get to Ephesians chapter 5, if we begin in verse 22 and read through 33, we're going to get the New Testament picture that Paul is giving as an apostle to talk to the families about how the relationship ought to work. Wives, be subject. I'm starting with verse 22. Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also wives ought to be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with word, that he might present her to himself, the church, in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So husbands also ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church. Because we are members of his body, because we are members of his body, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife, even as himself. And the wife must see to it that she respects her husband. That's not Old Testament culture. That is Paul looking to using the marriage and the way it should be to explain the relationship between Christ and the church. Christ is head of the church just as the husband is head of the wife. Clearly established here by Paul as he speaks this. But it's not all about authority. As a matter of fact, there is authority implied. If Christ is head of the church, then he's got authority over the church, right? So there's clearly some authority that comes that a man may need to exercise, is even called upon to exercise in the relationship with the wife. But the main emphasis here is relationship. Not at the exclusion or pushing out of the authority, but recognizing verse 25, husband loves your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her. This is not the man asking to be served for his own pleasure. It's not what this is about. This is the man leading the family for the good of the family, out of love for the family and out of love for his wife, to the point of being ready to give himself up for her. And this is not about the woman obeying an authoritarian man just because he can say, you do it, so then you have to. This also includes showing, doing this out of respect for the husband. This is a loving, respectful relationship with roles in it. And the roles include a man having responsibility of leadership. And it also includes the woman have a responsibility of working with the husband with respect. And apart from that, we are, we all struggle in our marriages from day to day. I mean, we're not all perfect at doing this. None of us are perfect at doing this. When we fall down on the job of living out this relationship as described here and the roles that go with it, we harm just a little bit the testimony of the church, because maybe it harms a lot the testimony of the church and about Christ, because it's a model for, it's a type for the relationship between Christ and the church. And in like manner, we as members of a church should be, are called to be, respectfully obedient to Jesus as the head of the church at every turn. Many churches today want to set aside the words of Christ in order to embrace things that they believe the culture has now brought to be and are right and okay. And I don't need to make another list of them. You know what they are. You know what churches embrace and accept, which is clearly contrary to the teachings of Christ himself, and certainly to the New Testament, and certainly to the natural order of the way things are seen in creation. And so it becomes non-optional for us to live out these roles as we're given. And you can see that being applied in numbers about these commitments that people are making. And you can see it being applied when the woman makes a vow and the husband hears it, he's got an opportunity to say, wait a minute, that's not wise, we're not going to go that direction. One of the things that has to be realized is the husband has some responsibility for the family and what it does as a whole, and we've got to be working together toward common goals. And if a spouse, a wife, would make a vow that didn't fit in with what the family could live out or was in conflict with other vows and commitments they'd made, well, then somebody's got to sort that out, and that's the role he's given. So this is very practical as well, because wives' vows can, if we think back to Numbers, wives' vows can affect the whole family. Also, this is a protection for women in the culture. Women in the culture that we see with Moses back in the time they are getting ready to enter the promised land, women have very little social power, social influence, very little influence of their own. And so to function well in the society, the man has a role to play of protecting and caring for his wife from that less powerful position. And so men can use power to protect them. That power is in this area of Ephesians. It goes back to Ephesians 5:28 there. Love your wives. So as they make vows, they didn't have the opportunity to read Ephesians 5:28, but a part of loving and protecting the wife is can be carried out with a husband with the proper motivation of loving her to protect her from a vow that's not going to work out. But let's not forget about the real theme for this chapter. It's easy to get all hung up on, well, all this stuff about women and their vows. This is about being honest and having the integrity to do what you're said. If you agree to something, you should do it. Go over to Matthew 5, 33 through 37. I think these verses are absolutely lined up with what he is, what was being talked about by Moses when these rule directions were given. So Matthew 5:33-37. Oops, gotta turn the page. Nope, yes. Again, you've heard the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it's the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything beyond these is of evil. And certainly making an oath or a vow by one of these things is not necessary. What Jesus is saying here, just say yes and just say no and do what you said. Don't lie and have integrity. Questions, comments? Okay. So hopefully nobody is going to be looking to beat me about the head and shoulders when we leave today, but this is what God said, and we need to embrace the word of God and follow it in the way that it's given to us. Well, certainly the Nazarite vow would be one. Beyond that, I didn't find very many, if any. I don't remember. It's not used very many times in the Old Testament. It is used a number of times I didn't bring out, just brought up enough to illustrate. But there are just not lots of vows. There are agreements made. We saw some of that in Genesis when... Isaac, for example, met with Abimelech, I'm working off of memory here, about where they were settling. Everywhere Isaac went, no, you can't use the well, you can't whatever. And so finally he gets an agreement and they sit down and formalize that. So there are those kinds of examples in the Old Testament, and I think that's exactly what he's talking about, is you make an agreement, you keep your agreement. You don't go back on it. You do what you said you were going to do, and you're honest. But I don't have a lot of other examples off the tip of my tongue to give you. Yes.
I have a question. I mean, you almost get the idea. Could be wrong, but they address it a few different times throughout Scripture. Do you think vow making was more common then than it is today? I mean, I guess today we definitely say like, "I promise I will do this," right? Or you see kids like pinky swear, right? Like,
yeah.
So obviously, same thing. Well,
I think there probably was more formality with a lot of agreements, but when I look around today and I just think about my own life and the buying a house, buying a car, going down through the list, in marriage, I made a vow, and you can just, I think we make a mountain of agreements these days. And one of the sad things I think about today's world goes right at what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 5. You may meet with somebody, and if they're a person of integrity and they say, yes, I will deliver it to your place for this amount of money, there are many people today, many, that just do it. And there's no squabbles. Everybody just does what they said they were going to do. There's an awful lot of people that will make a verbal agreement and they go, well, did you get that in writing from me? Well, I'm really not obligated to it unless it's written down. You know, we seem to have all kinds of hedges about life these days, starting with, what do we do with the scriptures? Well, culture's changed. People know more. That's very old. This is now. That was then. And that kind of compromise shows up everywhere, and I think it shows up in our agreements and our obligations to one another as well. And I think it shows up in vows we might make to the Lord. Lord, I'm going to not have anything to do with that situation, whatever, again. And then give it some time and you forget and you do. And, you know, I just think it's, I think we're awfully easily swayed away from keeping our commitments, even when we think we're pretty high in integrity and honesty. Did I answer your question?
Hey, Rick, I was curious. In chapter 29, it seems like the text flows from verse 39. These you shall offer to the Lord at your appointed feasts in addition to your vow offerings and your free will offerings. And so it seems like this chapter is an illustration of the processes by which people would give their vow offerings, which seem to be described in Leviticus chapter 22.
Mm-hmm.
In verse 17, acceptable offerings, it says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons, and all the people of Israel, and say to them, when anyone of the house of Israel or the sojourners in Israel presents a burnt offering as his offering for any of their vows or free will offerings that they offer to the Lord," and he basically just goes on to say that they're going to offer bulls, rams, whatever, like these are the acceptable types of free will or vow offerings.
Mm-hmm.
This seems to be like an illustration of, to put it in our words, like if I have my 6-year-old write a check from my checkbook for, you know, $1,000, you know, is that a substantial, like, it's a substantial offering, and, you know, that like, desire to give is a good thing, but at the end of the day, she's still under my authority, right?
So,
like,
right.
I think it's really just describing that if we have a zeal in young women or a zeal in the household that is not approved by the household leader, that it's null and void unless that household leader, you know, tacitly approves it or so on. So I think that, like, those sacrifices are described in the Levitical code, and then you know, what we have here is just like, you know, if I'm a family and we only have one cow and we have a couple of sheep, and my daughter makes a pledge that we're going to give our only cow to the Lord, then as a father I can, like, make that null and void for the sake of our household.
Well, yeah, and I think those are good illustrations and exactly the right for this. Now, you also mentioned about acceptable offerings, and we talked about the Nazirite vow a little bit as one of the kinds of vows that might be made. And if you go through the Nazirite vow, there's a lot of specific detail about the offerings you're going to do, when you're going to do it, how you're going to do it. Oh, and if you touch a dead body in the middle, you start over. This is how you start over. So God was very prescriptive about a lot of the offerings and vows that people might make. And that's absolutely correct. But yeah, that's you're right. It might be not as obvious at times when the man would choose to step in and say, not this time, in order to keep everything where it was. But the kinds of things you brought up are very obviously it would be talking about. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Well, let's set the stage for next week. Let's go to Numbers 31, and I'm going to read the first 12 verses, and we'll just see how far we get with this today, and we'll pick it back up next week. Where'd my tab go? Numbers 31, 1 through 12. "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take full vengeance for the sons of Israel on the Midianites. Afterward, you will be gathered to your people. Moses spoke to the people, saying, arm men from among you for war, that they may go against Midian to execute the Lord's vengeance on Midian. 1,000 from each tribe of all the tribes of Israel you shall send to the war. So there were furnished from the thousands of Israel 1,000 from each tribe, 12,000 armed for war. Moses sent them 1,000 from each tribe to the war, and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, to the war with them, and the holy vessels and the trumpets for the alarm in his hand. So they made war against Midian, just as the Lord had commanded Moses, and they killed every male. They killed the kings of Midian, along with the rest of their slain, Evi and Rechem and Zur and Hur and Reba, the 5 kings of Midian. They also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with the sword. The sons of Israel captured the women of Midian and their little ones, and all their cattle and all their flocks and all their goods they plundered. Then they burned all their cities where they lived and all their camps with fire. They took the spoil and all of the prey, both of man and of beast. They brought the captives and the prey and the spoil to Moses and Eleazar the priest and to the congregation of the sons of Israel to the camp of the plains of Moab, which are by the Jordan opposite Jericho. So God, Yahweh, comes to Moses and says, take vengeance for Israel on the Midianites, and then you will be gathered to your people. So what are they avenging? You remember?
Midianite women corrupted them, and Phinehas had to throw the spear to stop the plague after thousands died.
That's right. When they were on the plains of Moab, go over to Numbers 25. We'll just skip around on a few verses there to remind ourselves of what the Midianites got involved in. And why there's a vengeance here to be taken. So in 25, the first verse, it starts out that Israel was still at Shittim, and the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. And so this is what's going on. If we go down to verses 6 through 9, it says, then one of the sons of Israel, and it's exactly what's just described here, came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel while they were weeping in the doorway of the tent of meeting. And they were weeping because of the command that came from God to slay the men that were involved in this playing the harlot with these people. Now when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, and the priest saw it, he arose from the midst of the congregation, took a spear in his hand, went after the man of Israel into the tent, and pierced both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through the body. So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked. Those who died by the plague were 24,000. So how does that get to some kind of vengeance being needed? Go down to verse 16. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, be hostile to the Midianites and strike them. They have been hostile to you with their tricks, which they have deceived you in the affair of Peor and in the altar of Cozbi, the daughter of the leader of Midian, their sister, who was slain on the day of the plague because of Peor. God clearly is telling them this isn't just two groups of people with sinful attitudes carrying out their sinful desires. These people were trying to lead you into this. And the woman that was killed was a leader's daughter, and she was knowingly involved with being a part of this. And so that's a piece of it, but it's not the whole piece. We need to back up to Numbers 22. And when we get to Numbers 22, we're going to read verses 1 through 7, because this brings the history back in of how the Midianites got involved to begin with. The sons of Israel journeyed and camped on the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan opposite Jericho. That's where they still are when they start this war we're reading about in our current lesson. Now Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. So Moab was in great fear because of the people, for they were numerous, and Moab was in dread of the sons of Israel. Moab said to the elders of Midian, now this horde will lick up all that is around us as the ox licks up the grass of the field. And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of Moab at the time. So he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people, to call to him, saying, behold, a people came out of Egypt. Behold, they cover the surface of the land, and they are living opposite me. Now, therefore, please come and curse these people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps that I may be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the fees for the divination for their hand, and they came to Balaam and repeated Balak's words to him. So the Midianite leaders, as Balak asked them to come, as he was the Moabite, asked the Midianite leaders to come, we've got a problem here, and they're working together and scheming to see the Israelites defeated. Their idea is to bring Balaam over. He's a diviner and will do it for money, and so they want him to essentially say a curse against Israel. Well, Yahweh intervenes, and instead, Israel is constantly blessed. So they get mad at Balaam and send him packing. But they're still involved in wishing ill for the Israelites. And the Midianites get involved in this scheme to play the harlot, to drag them down morally, to cause them to sin against God. And that's what's being avenged here. Questions, comments? Okay, so what Moses says to do is arm men. We're going to go to war against the Midianites to execute the vengeance of Yahweh. And the army is going to consist as 1,000 men armed from all the tribes, totaling 12,000. Does that sound like a big army to you? I wouldn't want to face them today. But how many soldiers were available to the Israelites? Remember? We want to play the higher and lower, you're low. If you went back to Numbers 26:51, where I'm not going to turn there, I've got it right here in my notes. When they did the last census, it was 601,730. And they sent 12. But that's what they were asked to do. Who went with them? You saw that there. So Phinehas is sent along. Phinehas is the one that garnered the praise from Yahweh himself and was set apart to some extent because he had the same jealousy for God that God had for himself when he speared that man and woman sinning against God back in the days that they were playing the harlot. So he's sent there, and he's got in his hands, the way the New American Standard says it, the holy vessels and the trumpets. What's the role of the trumpets? Signal gathering, signal actions within the military, sound the alarm if something's going wrong. And so we've got the trumpets. Now, what are these holy vessels? Well, I'm going to tell you that when I was reading about holy vessels, nobody had any ideas. Some folks wanted to bring up a thing or two, but nobody suggested the Ark of the Covenant. Really, frankly, we don't know. One of the commentators said that that could easily be translated the holy vessels, even the trumpets, meaning the holy vessels that are the trumpets. Could be a way this is described. I don't know what holy things he might have been bringing with him beyond the trumpets, if there were any. Anything else is just pure speculation. So there they are. They've got their 12,000 men. They marched down to the Midianite area. They made war, and they killed every male, including the kings. Kings at that time were usually kings over cities. They were kind of like fiefdoms, but they clean house. And they also take the opportunity to find Balaam and put him to death by the edge of the sword. There were certainly some things about Balaam. He refused to say anything but what God had said, but he still was not considered a good prophet. He was still a prophet for hire, a person that would pronounce curses for money. And they captured the women and the little ones and their cattle and their flocks and all their goods. They burned their cities and their camps. They took all the spoil and the prey of both man and beast. So they have this war, and they're obviously completely overcome the Midianites. And they bring all of this stuff up and present it to Moses and Eleazar and in front of the whole congregation, Eleazar being the high priest. And they do so on the plain of the camp of Moab. So they are still where they were during the times that Balaam was pronouncing the judgments or the prophecies that God was giving him, that praised the Israelites, that were blessings on them, where Balak had been watching them. And so they have a very successful war. They only take a small portion of their fighting men to accomplish that war. Questions, comments?
Wasn't Moses' wife a Midianite?
Moses' wife was a Midianite, and I can't tell you what happened there. The Bible kind of is silent about her after her father-in-law leaves Moses on the plain when they're en route to Sinai. So, don't know what to say about that. I mean, Moses had to have known about the people groups if there wasn't even some people there he maybe knew personally. Now, you got to realize he left there 40 years ago, plus. So, any other questions, comments?
I think you have to remember that Midian was the son of Abraham.
Yes, good point. Mm-hmm. By marriage.
They were related.
They were related, yeah. And that's a good point that I didn't think about, reminding us of the history of the Midianites. So the Midianites are descendants of Abraham's second wife after Sarah dies. And the offspring from that marriage, they're the ones that settle this Midianite area. And so, of course, it's a little tough at this time in particular, but even today, to go over to the Middle East and find native people that somehow don't trace their lineage back to Abraham. And I'm not trying to belittle the fact that the Midianites were offsprings of Abraham, because they very directly were, but so too were the descendants of Esau that gave him trouble, and many of the other people up and around the area that they had trouble with. So, good comment. What, anything else? You know, the bringing up the fact that these Midianites were relatives, I think does continue to emphasize that so many times when there was judgment of the people, for example, when they were playing the harlot with the Midianites, God told Moses and had them send out their own people to slay their own brothers that were sinning in this way against God. And so a lot of times dealing with sin in other people was, and bringing judgment on the Old Testament, was people they knew and knew well, and so on. Okay, well, next time we're going to get the rest of the story, because this sounds like a wonderful victory as we quit today, but it's got a few other sides to it before they get done. So we'll see you next week and continue with the war on the Midianites.